I mean, I said, you know, vaguely that quantum correcting codes in one-way entangled distillation protocols were equivalent for polychannels, but that for non-polychannels, the quantum correcting codes were stronger than the one-way entangled distillation protocols. That the extra encoding got you something more, potentially. Well, the one-way entangled distillation protocols had this other extra property that the quantum correcting codes don't have, right? Which is the ability to send classical information for free. So maybe that would make them stronger in a different way. But it turns out it doesn't. So let's address that. So I'm not actually going to prove this, but only because I'm not going to go into all the epsilons and deltas, which unfortunately in this case are a little bit difficult. But the basic result is that forward classical communication does not help the one-way capacity. Okay? So I'm just going to sketch the proof. So what's the most general thing we could have, right? So we could have, we have Alice here. So she has her qubit input. And maybe she has some ancillas. And she could do some kind of encoding, which might involve measurements. I guess it might also involve throwing stuff away. And some qubits that get sent to Bob. Okay, so Bob down here, well, so they go through this noisy channel, and then Bob receives them. Okay, and Alice is meanwhile sent her classical bits to Bob by the parallel classical channel, and then Bob does something similar and gets his output. Okay. So why didn't the ability to send this classical communication help? Well, what we could do is we could look at the different values of this. We'll call this S. Okay? And and for each particular value of S, this operation is doing something, right? It's some completely positive, not necessarily trace preserving map, but it's a completely positive map from Alice to this output. Okay? So we can assume without loss of generality that Alice is sending all of this. There's nothing else, no other classical information around for her to send. And so she might as well send everything. Dobbs' measurement is also S. And Alice's input rho gets mapped to let's call it O sub S rho. Okay. Now, if this were unitary map, we'd be done. Well, unitary in the sense of adding ancillas, maybe throwing stuff away. But if it's unitary in the sense of encoding of a quantum error correcting code, which does the same things, then we'd be done. Right? So, how do we show that it is? Because actually, that's what we want to do. So actually, it's not necessarily true for all S. But we know that the overall operation has high fidelity. I guess, again, I'm not defining that for the people who don't already know it. But basically, you can get that high fidelity by averaging over the different values of x. And of course, that's weighted by the probability of having s occur. But in particular, there must be some s we'll call that S prime so let's call this R Bob's operation here if you apply R to OS of rho the fidelity between this and the original row is also high. Okay, has to be at least as high as the average fidelity, right? Because you can't get an average fidelity that's higher than all the things in the average. Okay, so in particular, S prime here. So in particular, if we pick S prime, we want to show that this OS prime is something that's very close to unitary in this encoding sense. Okay. Now, if the fidelity were perfect, then we know it would have to be, right? Because, well, if you can encode perfectly, then you can decode. Sorry. If you can decode perfectly, then you clearly haven't lost any information. So it's unitary in a sense, in the appropriate sense. Do people know what I say when I mean unitary encoding this way, or do I have to do all this hand waving again? Okay. What I mean is it's something that you could actually implement, and it's invertible, basically. When the fidelity is not near 1, well, then this is where the ugly part of the epsilons and deltas comes in. So it turns out, though, that fidelity is near 1, then OS is also close. Well, actually, so I'm not sure if that's quite right. At least the theorem I looked at didn't actually say that OS was close to unitary encoding. What it said was that there is some other O prime such that O prime is a unitary encoding. The term of the theorem I'm referring to was partial isometry, in case anyone wants something more rigorous. And it's also true that fidelity with the same decoding operation, right, number of parentheses here, it is high. So it's not quite as high. It's like, you know, epsilon goes to 2 epsilon. 1 minus epsilon goes 1 minus 2 epsilon, something like that. But it's still very high. So in the asymptotic limit, when the fidelity goes to 1, we have such an operation. And we can get rid of the cross complication. Okay? So there are questions about this.
So then why was the fidelity is 1 OS was unitary?
So it's unitary in this partial isometry sense. So it's The point is, so if the fidelity is 1, that means there is a way to invert it using a physical operation. And so if you have an invertible physical operation, then, I mean, R is the inverse of this thing, so it must itself be a physical operation. There's no information being lost. Other questions?
What's the relationship between the O prime and O?
Yeah, so I'm not sure. So like I said, this is referring to this theorem in the paper, which wasn't terribly specific about that. In general, you'd expect O prime to be something that's very close to OS, but I'm not 100% sure that's always possible. Basically, they derived O prime as from the properties of R rather than from the properties of OS prime. Other questions?
Who are these people?
Oh, so this is an old paper by Barnum, Mill, and Nielsen. It's called something like On Quantum Channel Capacity, something like that. Something about quantum channel capacities. Okay. It has a number of results of kind of this flavor of how you deal with the epsilons and deltas in these groups. Anything else? Okay. Then maybe we could move on to giving examples of quantum capacities. Seems like a good thing to do. So first example is going to be a pretty simple one to analyze, and that's the erasure channel. And so in particular, you may recall how we define this. The qubit is erased with probability p, meaning, of course, that Bob learns that it's been messed up in some way. And with probability 1 minus p, it's left alone. So it's important that it's, so for the thing I'm about to do, for the Clown capacity, it's important that we define it this way, that Bob learns which qubits have been erased, but Alice doesn't necessarily. Okay, and that's kind of sensible, right? Because, you know, if Alice sends a photon with the polarizations being 0 and 1, and Bob doesn't receive it, Bob knows that right off, but Alice doesn't know unless Bob tells her. Yeah.
So here, do you mean erase in the sense of all information gone, or just erase in the sense that something happened to it?
Well, so they're equivalent, right? In the sense, if by something happened, you mean something arbitrary.
Let's say the information gives you that something happened and this happened.
Right, no, so that's not an erasure channel. So the erasure channel is Bob gets told that this qubit has something wrong with it. But that something could be arbitrary.
Okay, so you just assume.
Or equivalently, it's, you know, the qubit is totally removed, yeah, and somebody tells Bob that this qubit was removed.
Okay.
So.
So then, for example, a qubit just goes to the zero vector, let's say,
that
channel, right? All qubits go to zero vector.
That's not an erasure channel. First of all qubits go to zero vector.
No,
that's
no,
not
a really
erasure
like, no, but in a particular qubit.
With probability p, it goes to zero vector.
Independent of what the input qubit is.
Yeah, see, that's not an erasure channel. Well, okay, so it depends how you define it. So if it goes to zero and there's an additional information that tells Bob that it's gone to zero, then it's an erasure channel. But if it just goes to zero and there's no extra information, then, you know, Bob doesn't know whether that's an error or whether it started at zero.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's not an erasure channel if there's no extra information. I did define, I mean, we've talked about erasures before. So it's the same definition as before. It's just that now it's a primitive property P rather than on, you know, some certain number of qubits. Okay? But in the asymptotic limit, that difference is not going to make, it's not going to matter much, right? Because when we look at n qubits, when n is very, very large, with very high probability, the number of qubits erased is going to be near p times n. Right, as n goes to infinity. And so this is the advantage of taking the asymptotic limits that we can deal with these probabilistic things, but still be pretty confident when we make statements like this. Okay. So really what you'd want to say if you want to include again all these epsilons and deltas, which I won't be, is that the number of qubits is between p plus or minus epsilon times n with very, very high probability. Okay, so let's start to think about capacities. Well, first of all, the two-way capacity, it's very easy to get a lower bound. And so when I say Q2 of p, I mean of the erasure channel probability p. Later, when I'll be talking about the depolarizing channel, I'll probably write it the same way, but hopefully you'll remember that we're talking about the depolarizing channel. It's a different p. Okay, so this p is the p here. So what's an easy lower bound here? Remember, Bob and Alice can talk, classically. And Bob is learning which qubits have been erased. Okay? So Bob might as well tell Alice. So now Alice knows what qubits have been erased, too. And, well, they could forget this more complicated protocol. Let's just do an entanglement distillation protocol, right? This is an example of something they can do, and they can teleport afterwards. So how many good EPR pairs can they get with this situation? Sorry?
1 over p.
1 over p. No.
I mean, that's
No. P is less than 1, so.
Oh, it's p. 1 minus p.
1 minus p, right? 1 minus p times n, of course. So the Q2, when you divide by n, that's going to be at least 1 minus p. Right? There's n altogether. They've lost pn, so they have n minus pn left, and they know which ones they are. So certainly, we can get at least 1 minus p as the rate. Okay? Okay. So let's set a lower bound on the one-way capacity. Well, that's harder, because now Bob can't tell Alice which ones are erased. So she doesn't know which ones to use. So we have to have some way of correcting the errors instead. So it turns out, well, okay, maybe I'll save that until we do the argument. It'll come out of the argument. So it turns out that the way to get a bound here is to use a random stabilizer code. Seems kind of dumb in some ways. I mean, just pick something at random. But it turns out to work very well. And actually, if you know about classical information theory and classical channel capacity, it turns out that you can, this is how Shannon's theorem is proved, the lower bound of Shannon's theorem. Use a random classical code, and that achieves the capacity.
Do you really mean use a random, or like sort of use a bunch of randoms on average?
So the argument in the classical case is a little more complicated. For this erasure channel, so in the classical case, what you have to do is you choose a random code and then you modify it slightly, and then with high probability that works. Okay? And for when we talk about the polarizing channel, we're going to do the same thing. But again, those are epsilons and deltas that I'm not really going to care about. In this case, I think actually, well, certainly I don't think you need to do any modification. Yeah, so I think it's the same sense that, almost the same sense, it's just you don't do the modification. So it's, you take a random code, and with high probability it works. But again, this is getting into the epsilons and deltas. So it's, in that sense, it's like the Gilbert-Bartrimov bound that we proved way back when, right? Which was, well, I don't remember if I was explicit about this, but we were counting, remember, we made this big list of codes, and we crossed off any codes that didn't work, okay? And what happened was, when we were below the Gilbert-Bartrimov bound, there were not just some codes that were left, but actually most of the codes were left. So what that meant is that if you took a random stabilizer code, then, you know, with the right parameters, then with high probability it has a good distance. Okay, and so the same kind of thing is going on here. So we take a random stabilizer code. And we're going to do one with n generators. Sorry, there's n qubits, r generators. Okay, so can it correct these erasure errors? Well, let's just focus on two separate erasure errors. So they're actually on the same qubits. Or they don't even have to be erasure errors, just any two errors. So what's the probability? So we have these two errors, E and F. So what is the probability that when we pick this random stabilizer code, that E and F have the same syndrome? Okay? Well, that's the same. Remember, E and F have the same syndrome if and only if E dagger F is in N of S. So it's equal to the probability that E dagger F is in N of S. Okay. Well, what's that probability? Well, assuming E and F are different, so I guess I need two distinct errors. If E and F are the same, the probability is 1. That's pretty obvious. But if E and F are different, then E dagger F is just some non-trivial polymatrix in P sub n. And we know that there's this Clipper group symmetry among the stabilizers, right? That maps, and in particular, this if we do a Clipper group operation, we can map this particular poly, E dagger F, into any other poly. Okay? And at the same time, we're mapping N of S to some other N of S. Okay? So if we choose a random stabilizer and some particular poly, then the probability that this poly is in that stabilizer, or is in N of S, is the size of N of S divided by the size of the poly group, actually minus 1, because the identity doesn't show up here. Okay. The point is, it's the same argument we had for the Gilbert-Bartrimov bound, that everything, every poly operator is appearing in an equal number of N of S's. And so there's a complete symmetry among them. Okay? Okay, so what is this? Well, let's ignore that minus 1. So N of S is, it's 4 to the n. Well, okay, let's write it 2 to the 2n minus r, because each generator cuts out a factor of 2 from N of S, right? And this is 4 to the n, or 2 to the 2n. So this is 2 to the minus r. Okay? So, on this page. Yeah, probably. Okay. So, so now what? Well, so we have the actual error. So we take this random stabilizer code. Alice encodes using it, sends a qubit through the erasure channel. Bob sees which ones are erased. And in this process, there's so on the erased qubits, there's this error E. Right? So this just acts on the roughly PN qubits that have been erased. And Bob wants to figure out what it is. So in other words, what we have to calculate is what's the chance for this particular E that there's some other poly error that has the same syncrom as it. So Bob measures the syncrom of the stabilizer code. If there's only one poly error that acts on the appropriate set of the erased set of qubits, then he's done. He knows which one it is. If there's two or more, then he might get confused. Yeah?
So then you know which one it is anyway?
He knows which qubits have been erased, but it could have been any combination of X, Y, and Z on those qubits.
Okay. So, but if he's lost his qubit, like, does he just make out the qubit if he's actually just lost his qubit?
Yeah, that would be enough. Right? But then it would be errors relative to the original value. So actual error E. So what is the probability that there is another F with same syndrome? Well, how many possible errors are there? There's 4 to the PN possible errors on this set of erased qubits. And for each one, the probability that it has the same syncrom as Z is 2 to the minus R. So the probability here is 4 to the PN over 2 to the R. OK? So in other words, this is less than 1 if R is greater than 2PN. Okay? And in fact, if R is 2P plus delta times N, then it's exponentially smaller than 1 with N. So letting delta get arbitrarily small, we see that we can choose R is equal to 2PN, or just slightly more than 2PN. And that means that K is N minus R, which implies that K over N is equal to 1 minus 2P. Okay? So that's the lower bound we get on this one-way capacity of the erasure channel. Okay? Think about that for a little while. Yeah?
Is there cases or a certain type of channel where a one-way communication has a greater capacity than a two-way communication?
No, I mean you don't have to use this back silence, right? Two-way communication subsumes one-way communication. Yeah. Anything you can do with one-way, you can do with two-way, just because you extra off.
Right.
For identity.
Yes, okay. Good example. There's not many cases where they are equal. So the dephasing channel, the perfect dephasing channel, are also equal. So that's more non-trivial. So this is a statement about classical communications. which is actually a really important non-trivial one. So classically, again, going to Shannon's noisy coding theorem, having a feedback channel, a back channel from Bob to Alice, doesn't help the capacity. Okay? But in the quantum case, at least in the case of the Schrödinger channel, you can see that it does. And it does in very general cases, in fact. So it's an important difference between quantum and classical. Yeah?
What's the Shannon bound? Like, what's the actual formula?
The Shannon bound is just equal to the mutual information between the regularized 1 over n. You look at one use of the channel, and then it's a mutual information between the random variable input and the output of the channel.
Maximized
over possible inputs. That's right, yeah. Anything else?
Do we have to go through this size of the normalized argument, or could you just say, oh, there's R generators, so there's 2 to the R syndromes, a random poly, one of the random syndromes, so it's just maybe 1 and 2 to the R?
I think once you get to this stage, you could do that. It's maybe less obvious from this first stage what the same signal. But they're all kind of equivalent. It's not that difficult an argument in the first place. Yeah.
Can you not just pick the e's that make you win? Well, I guess the
You don't get to pick the errors.
But
the channel is picking the errors.
Throw them away and pick the ones you like.
What?
If the qubit's already erased.
Because you don't know what it was originally, right? So an error is a statement of the value now relative to the original value. And you don't know what the original value was, so you can't pick the errors out. So maybe it's worth saying something about how this is different from the Gilbert-Rochefort bound, which is that if you did the same calculation, but you insisted it worked for all paired pairs, well, actually, since this is the erasure channel, it might not matter. But more generally, when we have this kind of random coding argument, the point is that there's only one error that actually occurs, e. Okay? But if you want to find the minimum distance of the code, then you have to look for the worst case error. So there'll be some errors, e, for which this doesn't work in general. If because there's a lot of possible errors, e, right? There's 4 to the pn possible errors, e. So what you would need then would be 16 to the pn over 2 to the r is less than 1. Maybe, again, for the Rayford channel, there's some way around that because they're acting on the same qubit. But the point is that in the general case, when you do this random coding for the channel capacity, you're kind of only interested in the average case error. Whereas for minimum distance, we wanted to know the distance of a code, then we were interested in the worst case error. And so then we get a worse answer. Okay, so that's maybe a technical point, but an important one. Because this random coding argument is going to be, at least in the case of polarized accounts, going to be kind of the same as the Gilbert-Rochefort bound, except for this point. Okay, so moving on. So these are lower bounds on the channel capacity. What about upper bounds? Let's put off the racing a little while. So upper bounds. Well, in the case of the two-way capacity, it's kind of clear. That's all we can do, right? Did I have anything that I wanted to say about that? Oh, yeah. Okay. So there is something which will be a tool that is useful for the one-way capacity anyway. So for the two-way capacity, it's kind of clearly all we can do, because the ones that are erased are gone, right? You don't really expect to be able to send anything through the ones that are gone. But we can still prove it. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to imagine looking at the convex combination of two channels. So what we're going to do is we're going to mix the identity channel with M. So let's define a channel M sub Q is equal to Q times, I don't want to define, Q times N. And then, so the probability Q, we do N, the probability 1 minus Q, we do the identity. Okay? And then I claim that the capacity of M is less than or equal to, well, what might you expect it to be? So with probability Q, we've done N. With probability 1 minus Q, we've done the identity. So it could be kind of Q times the capacity of N plus 1 minus Q times the capacity of the identity, which of course is 1. And this is for either Q1 or Q2. Okay? So this kind of makes sense, right? If we're doing one channel with one probability, one channel with another probability, we're not really going to do better than the average of the appropriate average of their capacities. But how do we prove that? Well, maybe there's something clever you can do that takes advantage of this. But there isn't, because if there was, then you could do better on N. So how does that work? So suppose we want to send k qubits through N. This is the proof. Okay, so we're going to do this by kind of a concatenated code. So we first encode 1 minus q times k randomly chosen qubit. So a subset, I should say, a random subset of size 1 minus q times k of these qubits that we want to send. And we encode them for n. So if we send those directly through n, then we get that many perfect qubits out of the n. Right? So how many qubits does this use? This uses 1 minus q times k divided by the capacity of n. Physical qubits. Okay? And then QK, so the remainder of these transmissions. So we now have the sum of those two. And so we encode these qubits for n. Okay? So that gives us this over the capacity of m physical qubits. Okay. And let's see what happens when we send this through the channel N. Well, first we can decode these. Well, it's kind of backwards. So first we decode the outer code, and then we encode the inner code. But the point is that these qubits have been sent perfectly through n. Yeah, OK, so I think I defined this concatenation the wrong way. First, we encode. Yeah, so first we encode for m, and then we encode okay, got to fix these numbers. We want to send, that's still right, I can erase that. So first we encode for m. So that gives us k over q of m physical qubits. And then a fraction 1 minus q of these. Are encoded for n. So that gives us 1 minus q over q of n plus q times k over q of m physical qubits. Okay. So we go through, we decode this n, these ones that have gone through n, this outer layer. Okay? And so now we have 1 minus q times this many qubits that have gone through the identity channel. And the remaining qubits, qk over q of m, went directly through n. Okay? And this, since these qubits were chosen at random, the ones that are going to experience the identity, this is just what you get by going through this channel m, right? Which is that at random, for some qubit, you do with probability q, you apply n, probability 1 minus q, you apply I. That's what we're doing here. Okay? So you have all the qubits experienced m. And we encoded them for m. Therefore, we get k qubits out. And we use how many? We use this many. So that's n equals 1 minus q plus q q of n over q of n times k over q of n. Okay? So we have so k over n is equal to Well, it's 1 over this. But k over n has to be less than or equal to, since this was, we're sending k qubits with n qubits through the channel n, this has to be less than or equal to the capacity q of n. Right? Which is saying that so 1 over this is less than or equal to q of n. So the q of n's cancel, and we have q of m over 1 minus q plus q of n is less than or equal to 1. In other words, this. Okay? Okay, so in any case, when we apply this to the two-way capacity of the erasure channel, there's one other thing we need to do to apply it to the two-way capacity of the erasure channel, which is, so first of all, we know that the capacity, when we have 100% of erasure, we know the capacity is 0, right? But to apply this argument, this actually only holds when the capacity is greater than 0 of n. Right, because we needed to use it to make these perfect things. And if the capacity is 0, we can't do that. Right, we get a divergence. So what we have to know is something about continuity. We have to know that when the probability is of erasure is close to 1, that the capacity is close to 0. And that's for the erasure channel, that's been proved. But once we do that, then we can just apply this directly to here. Okay? And so that tells us that the capacity is actually equal to 1 minus b. So for the one-way capacity, it's really not much harder. So we know that the Noctonic theorem is going to apply here, right? Which says that suppose there's an environment who's stealing qubits as we go through the channel with probability half. Right? In that case, Bob and this environment have the same number of qubits. And the classical information from Alice, well, you could imagine that was copied to both of them. And so if Bob could reconstruct Alice's state, then so could E, so could the environment. And you get two copies of the state. So the Noctonic theorem implies that Q1 of a half is equal to 0. And then again, this bound allows us to linearly interpolate between a half and the perfect channel. When you do that, you get this, 1 minus b. Okay? So why does that apply to the two-way case, right? Why not the Noctonic bound? How can we can do the two-way case when the erasure probability is greater than half? Well, the answer there is because the ability for Bob to talk to Alice creates a symmetry between Bob and Eve. Because Alice is only listening to information that comes from Bob, she's not listening to information that comes from Eve. So she doesn't throw out the ones Eve would want her to throw out, the ones that go to Bob. Bob wants her to throw out the ones that go to Eve. But Alice is listening to Bob, so she throws out the ones that go to Eve, and Bob wins. So he gets the entangled states and then the qubits, whereas Eve does not. Okay? So this Noctonic argument only applies to the one-way case. Questions? I have a question. What word did I use? I wonder how much longer this class would be if I could erase more quickly.
You need a room with more chalkboards.
There are rooms with more chalkboards. I have seen such things. Not many, but they exist. Okay. So, any questions on the eraser channel? Ready to move on to a more challenging channel, if not? Okay, so let's go to the depolarizing channel. So, in the case of the eraser channel, we could actually calculate these two capacities exactly. In the polarizing channel, we can't do anything close to that. We can just set some bounds. And, well, you'll see. OK. So what's the polarizing channel? I'll remind you. With probability p, we're doing nothing. Sorry. With probability 1 minus p, we're doing nothing. With probability p, we do a random poly error, x, y, or z. So the polarizing channel is this. N of rho is equal to 1 minus p times rho plus p over 3 for each x, y, and z. And so if you do that Choi isomorphism, that gives you the entangled state. Which is a mix of Bell states. And it's a particular mix. It's you have phi plus with probability 1 minus p, and then p over 3 of each of the other Bell states. So do people know what these are? Phi plus. Okay. So this family of states here is called the Werner states. So the depolarizing channel, since it's a poly channel, entanglement distillation and the quantum error correction are the same. Quantum error correction codes for the depolarizing channel are the same as entanglement distillation protocols, one-way entanglement distillation protocols for the Werner states. Okay? So let's look at the one-way capacity. So again, we'll get a lower bound using the random stabilizer code. And the argument is similar. So we'll take R generators. And so it's basically the same argument that probably getting two errors, the probability of having the same syndrome is, again, 2 to the minus r. And so for the particular error e, we want to know what's the probability of having the same syndrome. Sorry, probability that another error has the same syndrome as e. Well, that's less than or equal to the number of errors divided by 2 to the r. And so what I'm writing for the number of errors is not the actual number of errors, because any possible error could occur here. It's just that some errors are very unlikely. So this is the number of errors in typical set. So the typical set is the most likely kind of error, which, of course, is one that has roughly pn over 3 x's, pn over 3 y's, and pn over 3 z's arranged randomly. Okay? And so in fact, if you do counting, well, that's so that's 3pn, sorry, not p, p over 3n x's, p over 3n y's, p over 3n z's. So that's pn total errors, right? And if we were to take just an arbitrary set of pn total errors, we'd still find that most of those cases were evenly distributed between x, y, and z. So the number of typical errors is basically the same as the number of total errors with weight pn, which we've already calculated, remember. And what do we calculate it to be? We calculate it to be h of p, well, roughly, or the log of it, to be h of p plus p log 3 times n. So this is 1 over n times the log. Okay, and h of p, you remember, was this entropy function minus p log p minus 1 minus p log 1 minus p. All these logs are base 2. Okay? And so if you do the same arguments before, what we get, that tells us that, so n tip is about 2 to the n h of p plus p log 3. And so n tip is less than 2 to the r, meaning that this probability is small when r is greater than n h of p plus p log 3, which implies that n minus k is greater than here. So taking k over the other side, dividing by n, we find that k over n is less than or equal to 1 minus h of p minus p log 3. Okay? And this then forms a lower bound on our capacity. Okay. So this formula is maybe familiar to you. We saw this before in the quantum Hamming bound, which, remember, before was an upper bound on non-degenerate codes. This time it's a lower bound on the quantum capacity, again because it's an issue of worst-case error versus typical error. Right? If you look at the Gilbert-Bartramaugh bound, which is the lower bound on distance, on a code of distance, distance p times n, then you had two p's in here. So it's h of 2p and minus 2p log 3. And so that factor of 2, that's the difference between the worst case error and the typical error. So when we go to typical error, we go up to this Hamming bound, essentially, for the random code. Okay. And a similar phenomenon happens classically. Okay? Questions? Yeah?
Where's the concern capacity? I can't calculate the logs.
Ah, yeah, good question. So, where do I put this? So this equation goes to 0 at p equals point 18929. And I don't quite need all of those significant figures, but the last one is the only one I can get rid of, for reasons that I'll tell you shortly. Okay? So unfortunately, I can't prove that that's, well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, I can't prove that that's an upper bound where that capacity is zero. So I can't quite do, what can we prove about when the capacity hits zero? Although I should make sure there are no other questions before I do that. Okay. Okay, so again, we can apply no cloning bound, right? So now there's an eavesdropper or an environment. Which will steal qubits with probability half. But now, since it's not an erasure channel, it's a depolarizing channel, when the environment steals a qubit, she doesn't tell Bob, she simply replaces it with a random qubit. Okay? So in this case, we again have zero capacity by no cloning bound. Because again, the environment and Bob are in symmetric situations. Right? So what kind of depolarizing channel does this correspond to? It's not a probability half, because when she replaces it with a random qubit, there's also a chance that it'll be right, just randomly. So what's the chance of being right? Well, 1 minus p is equal to a half plus a quarter of the time this random qubit is right. So a half the time the qubit stays and it's right. Half the time it's stolen, but then it still has a 1/4 chance of being right. Right? Because when it's stolen, it's an equal probability of I, X, Y, and Z. Okay? So this is 5/8. And therefore Q1 of 3/8 is equal to 0. Okay? So it turns out you can actually even do better than that with a no cloning argument. Because, well, this is kind of a stupid cloner. It's a really bad cloner in that Eve is getting perfect information. But actually, all that we needed was that the environment and Bob were in a symmetric situation. So it turns out an optimal symmetric cloner but it's imperfect. Should I write it down? So this third register is something that's thrown away. And these first two qubits, one goes to Bob, one goes to the environment. And you can see that symmetric between Bob and the environment in terms of density matrices they're getting. And maybe it's a little hard to see, but so this corresponds to p equals a quarter. Which says that actually q1 of a quarter is equal to 0. Okay. That's 0.25 compared to this 0.1893. So there's still a considerable gap there. Questions so far? Everyone's getting tired. OK, so running out of time. So go back to this board, I guess. So the thing is that actually we can do better than that. We can do better than the random code. And that's kind of surprising because, well, if you're thinking classically, that never happened. Classically, the random code was always optimal. In the quantum case, it's not. And the reason for that is that we can use degeneracy. Okay? And so, for instance, if we concatenate a random code with a repetition code in some particular basis. Too many repetitions there, T. With repetition code, say in Z basis, then we can do better than this 0.18929. And in fact, the best one uses two concatenated repetition codes, the best known one, I should say. And what we can get is we can extend this limit up to 0.19088. See, a huge improvement over the previous result. But the point is not that it's numerically large. Although, of course, it is. But that you can do it at all, right? Because what this tells us is that degeneracy is actually important. So remember for the minimum distance case, I didn't know of a case where, not just me, we don't know of a case where you can exceed the quantum Hamming bound, the degenerate code. But in this case, you are exceeding kind of the equivalent of the Hamming bound. Well, it actually is the Hamming bound. It's just now the average case error again instead of the worst case error. Okay, in the channel capacity, the asymptotic limit, we can do better by taking advantage of degeneracy. Kind of remarkable phenomenon, and this is the reason why we don't actually know the capacity of this depolarizing channel. It's kind of embarrassing. It's a very simple channel. And there's still this relatively large bound between just if you look at the place where it hits zero, between this 1/4 and this 0.19, right? So there's a noticeable gap there. And we don't know what the capacity is in the intermediate region. We don't know where it really hits zero. And that's because we don't know how to deal with this degeneracy, if you will. OK? So let me say something quickly about the two-way capacity. So there's an upper bound. We know that Q2 of a half is equal to 0. And that's because the corresponding Brunner state is separable. Okay, so that means that they could have, Alice and Bob could have created this Brunner state using just classical communication and local operations. And therefore, if they could distill entanglement from it, they'd have some way of creating entanglement without any quantum communication between them. So we know that's not possible. Okay. And it turns out, actually, that there's a non-zero two-way capacity for anything less than a half, any error rate less than a half. Okay. And I'm really glad I assigned this a problem on the problem set, because I don't have time to go through it. But you'll get a chance to do that yourself. Okay. Okay. So I want to make I wanted to find one more thing related to capacity, and then we'll be done with capacities. And next week we can go into topological code. And that's the coherent information. So suppose we purify this channel N into something that's unitary acting on the channel in the environment. And we'll call the environment E. So then we can define the coherent information . So if you have an input rho, the coherent information of rho going through the channel N is the entropy of N of rho. So you send the state through the channel. This is just a single qubit state, or you can generalize for larger channels. Send the single qubit through the channel. You find N of rho and then calculate its entropy. But you have to subtract out the entropy that's been eaten up by the environment. If you think about it briefly, you'll see that this definition, I had to pick a purification in order to define it this way. It doesn't actually depend on which purification you choose, because the entropy is going to be independent of that. Okay? Yeah?
Is this called the increase in the entropy of the environment? I mean, if your environment also
depends. Well, yeah. So when I purify, I'm assuming that the environment is starting in a pure state. So it's the increase from zero. I mean, if the environment is starting in a mixed state, then I'm not sure this is invariant. I mean, it may depend on the actual state of the environment. But to implement, I mean, when we talk about purifying something, we usually mean on some particular pure state input. You can always use it to be zero, right? And anything else is absorbed into the operation of the channel. Okay, so let me just state two results about the coherent information. So one of them is that this channel is correctable. So now, okay. So now this is a finite. And this definition doesn't depend on being qubits. Okay? So you can define the coherent information just as well for any dimension, And so this first theorem is going to be for higher dimensions. This theorem doesn't make sense for qubits, which is that the Lepian information gives us another form of the quantum error correction conditions. Which is to say that this channel is exactly correctable if and only if the coherent information is equal to the entropy of the input. Okay? And so what that means, you can maybe kind of see, is that, well, as the state goes through the channel, its entropy might increase. But all that increase is canceled by an increase in the entropy of the environment. Okay? So in some sense, all that's happening is the environment is becoming entangled with some ancilla. That's not a proof. The proof is not incredibly hard, but since I'm out of time, I'm not going to say anything about it. Okay? But basically, this is saying that the environment, based on what we said before, this is saying that when this is true, the environment has no information about the encoded state. And the other theorem that makes it relevant to this lecture is that the coherent information, suitably regularized, gives you the channel capacity. The one-way capacity. Okay, so this is similar to Shannon's noisy channel coding theorem. So remember, the noisy channel coding theorem, I said it out loud. There's a mutual information between the input of the channel and the output of the channel. And then we maximize over input to the channel. Okay? But the difference here, well, first of all, we use the coherent information instead of the mutual information. But the other big difference is that there's this annoying end. Here. So in Shannon's noisy coding theorem, you only had to look at one use of the channel. In this case, you have to look at many uses of the channel. And then, well, of course, when you use many uses of the channel, you can send more qubits, right? So you have to then divide out by the total number of qubits that you're sending to get the rate. And we take the limit as n goes to infinity. And the reason we have to do that is because of this issue of degeneracy. That this is an example, this depolarizing channel is already an example of a case where the n equals 1 capacity would give you the random codec thing. But as you go to larger n, you can do better. And that's why I have to take this limit. And that's really annoying. If we didn't have to do that, then we could calculate this capacity. This is relatively easy to do. Or if we had some good bound on how this went, so that we knew that by n equals 10, it was within, 1/10, and so on. It is that we had some idea of how close this asymptoted to the proof capacity. Then we could estimate this for that appropriate number of uses and get very tight estimation of the channel capacity. But we don't know really anything about the behaviors as n goes to infinity. And so it gets really tough to deal with. And so in that open question, that's the end of the lecture. Are there questions?